Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 3rd, 2009. I'm Stuart Wills, sitting in for our usual host, Robert Frederick. This week, we'll hear about new evidence for liquid water on Mars in the geologically recent past, courtesy of the Mars Phoenix lander. We'll find out about the delicate interdependence of birds and forests in the Serengeti ecosystem, and we'll explore the evolutionary origins of nervous systems. All this plus our usual roundup of the latest stories from our online daily news site, Science Now. Just over a year ago, in late May 2008, NASA's Phoenix lander touched down on the surface of Mars to begin its investigation of the icy soil in the planet's polar regions. The lander found ice, all right, but also a surprising suite of evidence for the presence of liquid water in the area within the past few million years. Peter Smith, principal investigator for the Phoenix mission, spoke with Science Podcast host Robert Frederick about that evidence, reported in a paper in this week's issue.
The Phoenix mission landed in the polar region of Mars, where we thought there would be ice near the surface. We found ice at our landing site, and the paper addresses the question of whether there has been liquid water associated with this environment before. And we have tried to attack that question from several different directions, and as you might suspect, the soil doesn't talk to you, so you have to tease out various clues here and there and try and do your best to see what the history might have been in this environment. And what we found is that there's calcium carbonate in the soil at the level of about 4%. Calcium carbonate typically forms in liquid water, almost always on the Earth, although it can happen in association with volcanoes, but that seems unlikely in this case. We found that the soil does release water as you heat it up, and we've seen snow falling, which if the climate were just maybe a few tens of degrees warmer, you could actually imagine that snow melting. And so we've done a series of experiments to see if liquid water is associated with the ice that is found in the northern plains. And we feel that in the recent history of Mars, the last few million years, that it's likely thin films of water existed at this location. Now, there's some question as to whether the soil originated right under the lander or over years blew into this site and could have come from another location. But wherever it came from, water was very likely involved in its formation.
Now, the search for liquid water on Mars is often associated with the potential for habitability. Do these results from Phoenix suggest a habitable planet for life in the past few million years?
Well, it's hard to say if life is actually associated with these soils. In fact, we have no evidence to talk about life itself. But we see a lot of the ingredients that life needs. And therefore, in a warmer and wetter climate, this really could be a soil that is habitable. It is alkaline, about the same alkalinity as our Earth oceans. And it has salts, it has energy sources, chemicals that can be used for energy or food for microbes. So there's a lot of the basic ingredients for life. But unfortunately, we weren't able to measure every single necessary ingredient for life. For instance, nitrates and phosphates were impossible for us to measure.
Now, the energy source, this was perchlorate in the soil?
Yes, this was found in an instrument that was doing wet chemistry. In other words, we actually brought water with us from Earth in sealed chambers, and we'd put soil in a beaker and break the seal on the chamber with the water and mix the two together. So we have a solution, and we wanted to find out what would go into solution in terms of salts of all different types. Would the salts that go into solution, for instance, be similar to the mixture of salts in the Earth's ocean? There are many papers that have hypothesized an ancient ocean in this environment, so you might expect salt to be left behind if there's an ocean. And we didn't see very much salt, but the surprise was to find perchlorate, ClO4, chlorine with four oxygens, and it was the largest concentration of any salt or ion that we found. And we see it at 1% or 2% concentration in the soil, which is rather large for a material that on the Earth is an impurity in drinking water at the parts per billion level. And very interesting material because believe it or not, we use a perchlorate substance, ammonium perchlorate, as an oxidizer in our rocket fuel when we use the solid rockets at launch. So this was like, oh my gosh, did we somehow get the rocket fuel mixed into the soil? And so we did a careful analysis to make sure we had not made that sort of mistake, and indeed we couldn't see quite how that could happen. So interesting stuff, very useful on the Earth as an oxidizer. Also, food for microbes. They really thrive on perchlorate because of the energy locked into its structures.
Now, you said that calcium carbonate found in the soil was not from volcanoes. What's the evidence for that? I mean, Mars has one of the biggest volcanoes in the solar system, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it certainly does. But typically, calcium carbonate forms with the CO2 in the atmosphere dissolving into liquid water and interacting as a weak acid with the soils and leaching out the calcium to make calcium carbonate. And in fact, we see the soils are cemented, which could very well be part of the process of making the calcium carbonate. Now, to come out of a volcano, typically these are, I think there's one volcano at the Earth that I know of that actually flows carbonate-rich lava. And at low temperatures, that's somewhere in Africa. You know, it's not impossible that that's what's happening on Mars, but it seems very unlikely. The type of volcanoes we see are not that type of volcano. They're much hotter.
Now, in looking at the subsurface ice, what was the physical evidence for the water as ice on the planet?
Well, we rapidly found that as we dug with our robotic arm, that we had a very hard and resistive layer about 5 centimeters beneath the surface. And this is where we expected to find an ice table. And indeed, there were certain measurements that we made that really cinched the case, I think, that this is water ice and not some other material. And one is that it has the proper spectrum. The other is that we were able to get chunks of this material into an instrument we call the Thermal and Evolved Gas Analyzer. In other words, it's an oven. And we can heat up the material, and at 0 degrees centigrade, we saw water coming out of the material. And with a mass spectrometer, we could make sure that it had a mass of 18, which is, of course, 2 hydrogens and an oxygen. So there seems very little doubt that this is water ice. And in addition, we could see the material sublimating over the course of a few days and some pieces disappearing. The geological morphology or the appearance of the terrain around us was very indicative of ice processes, periglacial processes, we call them. And that's where, as temperatures change from the warmest summer days to the coldest winter days, you can expand and contract ice, and it tends to form polygonal structures. And that's exactly what we see here. It just seems clear that all the lines of evidence that we've investigated point towards a permafrost or a, you know, periglacial environment.
As to the atmospheric ice, we often hear about there not being very much of a Martian atmosphere, but if there are clouds of ice up there that are snowing down, does this at all change the understanding of Martian atmospherics?
Well, certainly the pressure and the temperatures of the atmosphere are as we've always thought they were. However, the clouds appear to be quite different than we might have imagined in the sense that they're very much like Earth cumulus clouds, the ones we saw. And these clouds are, well, they have particles, ice particles, that can be quite large and surprisingly large. We thought they might have been 2 or 3 micron size ice particles, and indeed they're more like 100 microns in size. So they're very large ice crystals that are growing inside of these clouds. And we see snow in the later part of the season, the summer season, into fall. And that snow just comes down late at night and evaporates in the morning. So there's a cycle between the water on the surface in the morning that gets evaporated into the sky, and then the clouds form in the late afternoon, and in the evening it snows back down to the surface. So there's a daily cycle that we observed.
How about winds? Are they causing things like dunes or ripples in the Martian soil?
Well, I was surprised not to see any dunes at all. We don't see any structures that look like windblown features that we attribute, you know, to saltation or dust storms. And we know there's dust storms in this region, and yet this appears to be a region where material is being removed rather than deposited. There's no lack of sand dunes on Mars. They're omnipresent, and it was surprising to me to see the lack of them, complete lack of them in this region. So I suspect that this is a place where the sand is originating rather than ending up. And of course, that can change over time. Wind patterns can change with climate changes. And we know that Mars has climate changes.
With the findings thus far that we have from Mars, in some, including those from the Mars Phoenix lander, is it likely that we would have the ability to go to Mars and, you know, have water and enough materials on which to survive and perhaps fuel our rockets to come back home?
Well, you know, we joked about that now we can live off the land. You've got rocket fuel in the soil that could be separated out, easily separated, because all you need is water. It's very, very soluble. But frankly, I think that's pretty much a long shot. Unless it's much more concentrated than 1%, you'd have a fairly significant mining operation. The other question is, would water be available for astronauts? And I think melting the ice under the soil is probably not a great way for astronauts to find water on Mars. Of course, it is water, but when winter comes, this is a very severe environment to be in. So I would suggest that astronauts go more towards the equator and try and find an underground aquifer where you could drill down to water and bring it up to the surface. And I think that's really what we should be looking for as we think about colonization of Mars.
Peter Smith of the University of Arizona's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory is the lead author of a paper overviewing evidence for liquid water in the geologically recent past in Mars's polar regions. It's one of four papers in this week's Science that report early results from the Mars Phoenix lander. The persistence of isolated riverine forest patches in Africa's Serengeti region has been something of an ecological mystery. How do these forests survive amid fire, competition from savanna grasses, predation, and other environmental stresses? A new paper in Science provides at least part of the answer. They get a helping hand, or if you prefer, a helping beak, from the birds that depend on the forest for food and habitat. The paper's lead author, Gregory Sherram of the University of British Columbia's Biodiversity Research Center, spoke with Science podcast host Robert Frederick about the work.
The research that we've been doing is based at a Serengeti National Park, which is in East Africa, and we're working there in a series of riparian forests or riverine forests, which are sort of small forest patches along rivers. And the big question that we've had there is, why are these forests able to persist in a sort of a savanna environment? One of the things that we've discovered, which we find quite interesting, is that bird populations actually support or maintain the stability of these little forest patches.
How so?
Essentially, the bird populations alter the quality of the seeds of the trees, which alters the number of those seeds which are attacked by beetles or weevils. And seeds which are attacked by beetles tend not to grow. And so by altering the number of seeds which are attacked by beetles, they then allow an increasing number of seeds to germinate and become small trees.
What do you mean when you say the birds alter the quality of the seeds?
Well, the birds are just sort of skinning the outside off of the seeds, and they look like little cherries, most of them. Typically, they have a single little hard seed in the center. The birds are either sort of chewing on them and then dropping them or taking the skins off while they're on the tree. Not entirely sure how that part works.
So they're eating them and regurgitating them, or it's actually processed through the bird and dropping to the forest floor?
Typically, they're actually dropped from the bird's beak. So you can see little sort of almost chew marks on the seeds where the birds have been clipping off the sort of the flesh of the seeds.
What is it about the birds processing the seeds that keeps the beetles from attacking the seeds?
I think this is something which is still a mystery, and I'd really like to know the answer. It may be that there's something about the seeds in terms of the smell of the seeds, or the beetles may have a cue which attracts them to the seeds which are still sort of moist or are tastier. Not entirely sure.
And when the beetles did attack the seeds, at what rate did the attacked seeds germinate?
Virtually none of the seeds which had been attacked were able to germinate. So the beetle or weevil drills a little hole in the seed and then consumes out all of the contents of the seed, essentially leaving the seed coat, the hard seed coat, behind.
And the seeds are only attacked when they're on the ground? They're not attacked in the trees?
And that was a good question, which led to a considerable amount of tree climbing and collecting seeds which were about to fall off the tree. And it seems that that is, in fact, the case. They're only attacked once they reach the forest floor.
So it's only the seeds that are on the ground that are attacked by the beetles. If the seeds are processed first by the birds, then what rate do the beetles attack the processed seeds?
The beetles attack the processed seeds at a fairly low rate, about 5% of the seeds overall, which have been processed by birds, are subsequently attacked by the beetles.
Over what time interval is that?
I think that was 3 years of work that we put into this.
And if the seeds aren't processed by the birds, then what's the attack rate on the seeds?
The attack rate varies a fair amount, from about 70% up to about 90%. And that's across the different types of forest patches. So forest patches which are quite closed will have a fairly low attack rate of about 70%. And then the ones which are quite open will have a much higher attack rate, so about 90%.
So a decline in trees or in birds processing seeds from the trees would lead to a decline in the seeds that would germinate, which again then would lead to a decline in the trees and presumably then a decline in the birds.
Precisely. And so in the end, I think there are probably a variety of factors at work leading to the dissolving of this forest. And so we wouldn't necessarily want to claim that this is the only process going on, but we feel that it's within the other processes, it's a fairly important one. Now, the work on these forest patches goes back about 30 years. There were papers that came out in the mid-1970s describing the slow decline of these forest patches and wondering why that was happening. The results at the time suggested that it was fire eroding the edges of these little forest patches. And subsequently, we've been working to look at the sort of the actual mechanism by which these forests decline.
So is it your team's hypothesis then that it was fire that started this downward trend in these forests?
Absolutely. Certainly fire can erode the forest from the outside, can also remove adult trees. And so fire plays a fairly significant role in the initial opening of these small canopy tree patches or these small patches of forest.
And these are natural fires?
Some are natural fires, some are lit by park managers, and some are lit by poachers, which are unfortunately still a problem in that area. And so the fire frequency may or may not be sort of what is historically normal for the area. But on a positive note, what may be more interesting is that it's not necessarily just birds per se, but it's a particular group of birds. That group of birds is required in order to maintain the forest as a sort of a viable little forest patch. And regardless of the state of that forest, the actual number of species of birds remains relatively constant. It's actually the types of species which change. And so in order to maintain the forest, what you actually need are these forest-specific birds, these birds that are able to process these seeds and so eliminate the potential for these beetles to attack them. The seeds, that is, not the birds.
Is this mechanism behind forest maintenance happening elsewhere, other forests?
Well, I think that's the conservation crux of the question and is sort of what drives some of our interest in this process. And so any process which we can find which either controls or maintains forest regeneration or plays a part in establishing new forests in areas which have either been removed by people or degenerated could play a role in sort of future conservation. And so while we've discovered this process in Serengeti, it may well be important elsewhere as well.
Gregory Sherem is the author, with A.R.E. Sinclair and Roy Turkington, of a paper in this week's Science on how birds stabilize riverine forests in the Serengeti. Nervous systems are among the most amazing of bodily and biological systems, in their complexity and their diversity across nature. But how did the whole thing get started? In an essay this week, science news writer Greg Miller looks at the current state of the art in scientific research on the evolutionary origins of the nervous system, going all the way back to the question of the first neuron. He talked with Science Podcast host Robert Frederick about it.
This essay is about the evolutionary origins of nervous systems. There's a tremendous variety of nervous systems represented in modern animals. And so what I was trying to do here was to go way, way back and try to figure out what's known about the origins of the very first neurons and the very first nervous systems.
What, if any, consensus is there on the timing of the evolutionary origin of the nervous system?
Well, not a lot. I think there's a consensus that neurons and nervous systems arose very early in the evolutionary history of animals, probably, depending who you talk to, 600, 700, 800 million years ago. But there's still a lot that's not known about the early evolution of animals, and so that really complicates how you think about the evolution of something like the nervous system.
Might the nervous system or neurons have evolved independently several times?
A lot of people think that, although some people are resistant to that idea. In some ways, it's more parsimonious to think of a single evolutionary origin, so that neurons, for example, evolved once, and that was that. But there are some reasons to think that that's not actually what happened, that neurons may have evolved multiple times in different lineages of animals, although it's really far from resolved at this point.
What advantages would having neuron cells confer over having other signaling methods?
Well, neurons give you a few things. They can be a lot faster. An electrical impulse traveling down a neuron is a lot faster than the diffusion of a chemical signaling molecule, for example. And they give you specificity. So, for example, a neuron can connect to specific points on an animal, like a photoreceptor cell in one place with a muscle cell in another place. So they allow animals to have more coordinated responses to things in their environment and also allow them to respond more quickly in a lot of cases to things in their environment.
Is that what's fueling the debate then about whether or not the nervous system or nerve cells evolved independently several times? Because that does sound like a tremendous advantage.
Yeah, it's a really big advantage. And I think that that might fit with the idea that animals that had a lot of the building blocks in place to build neurons or build a nervous system would have had an incentive to do that.
What other features are there of nerve cells that distinguish them from all other cells?
That's actually a really hard question, and it's kind of at the root of this. When you want to think about what the evolutionary origins of neurons are, you have to know what a neuron is. And that seems like a simple thing to define, but it's really not. I guess one of the things that everyone I spoke to thought that all neurons have in common as a defining feature is directionality. They receive information at one end and they transmit information at another end. Neurons, as we think of them, typically use electrical conduction. They are able to manage the flow of ions across their membrane to create and conduct electrical impulses. So there's some things like that that all neurons seem to share. And then there are other things that we typically think of neurons having, like axons to transmit signals and dendrites to receive signals, that a lot of neurons have, but not necessarily all. And so you can get into some sort of murky areas there. But the directionality seems to be the key thing that all neurons have.
What about components then? Not whole neurons, but are there components of what could be the building blocks of neuron cells that exist in other species that predate modern neuron cells?
Yeah, one component of neurons, the ion channels in the membranes of neurons that give neurons their ability to generate and conduct electrical impulses, seem to be evolutionarily very, very ancient molecules that are present in even bacteria and archaea and other kinds of single-celled organisms. So paramecium, for example, have ion channels, and they generate impulses that are very similar to the action potentials, the electrical impulses that neurons use to conduct signals. So all kinds of very ancient organisms, or at least their modern relatives, have ion channels. So that's one component of neurons that seems like it's been around for a very long time, way before the first neurons evolved.
Other examples?
Another interesting, really interesting organism or group of organisms are sponges. Sponges are, in the eyes of many researchers, the living animals that most closely resemble the ancestor of the common ancestor of all animals. And they don't have a nervous system, but they do have a lot of the building blocks. They have ion channels, but more recently it's been discovered that they also have a lot of proteins that are found at the synapses, the contact points that neurons use to communicate. And why sponges would have these synaptic proteins is kind of a mystery, because they don't have neurons, they don't have synapses, but the genome project in sponges is revealing that they have a lot of these proteins. To a lot of researchers, sponges really look like an animal that's on the verge of evolving a nervous system. It has a lot of the cellular components of a nervous system, but all these building blocks just don't seem like they're put together the right way.
What's the next step up, then, the evolutionary tree of life?
Well, a lot of researchers would say, and again, there's a lot of controversy about exactly how all of these branches split off the tree of life in early animal evolution. But the two groups of animals that most people would say come next are tenophores, which are comb jellies. They're marine invertebrates that sort of look like blobs and float around in the ocean, beating their cilia to move. And cnidarians, which is a large group that includes jellyfish and anemones and corals. And both of those groups, tenophores and cnidarians, have neurons that any neuroscientist would recognize as a neuron, and they have simple nervous systems.
So, like you said, really the difficulty in pinning down the origin or origins of neurons is getting at the origin or origins of animals. What about the origin of the centralized nervous system, a brain, then? Any consensus about that origin?
Well, that's another controversial issue, too. Tenophores and cnidarians are usually described as having a diffuse nervous system. They have neurons that are connected in a sort of net or a web. And as you get a little further along in evolutionary time, you find brains and nerve cords and more concentrated nervous systems. And so there's a fair amount of debate also about when exactly nervous systems first got centralized. And one main line of thinking on this is that the common ancestor of all animals with bilateral symmetry, which are called bilaterians, already had a centralized nervous system with a brain and a nerve cord running towards its back end. And a lot of people think there's good reason to support that from studies that look at genes involved in organizing the nervous system in different kinds of animals. But there are some other researchers that question some of those findings and have some other evidence that doesn't necessarily agree with it. So it's another one of these issues that's still a little bit up in the air.
Are scientists hopeful that they'll be able to pin down the origin of the nervous system? Perhaps modern bilaterians may yield some insights?
Well, I think we're making progress, and the genomic work is certainly helping, and I think a lot of people say it'll help a lot when we sample more and more of these animals that have ancient evolutionary roots. We need to know a lot more about the genomes of a lot more different kinds of animals to begin to start resolving some of these issues.
That was Greg Miller, whose essay on the origins of the nervous system appears in this week's issue of Science. It's part of a year-long series of essays on evolution in celebration of the Year of Darwin. You can find links to this and other essays in the series and more at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. The Institute of Medicine, part of the U.S. National Academies, released a report this week on comparative effectiveness research, a hot topic for the current Congress and administration. Here with more is Science Deputy Editor for Commentary, Barbara Jasny.
Comparative effectiveness research analyzes different medical treatments and healthcare services to determine what works best for which patients. Its goal is to improve health outcomes on a wide range of measures, such as infant mortality and chronic disease burden. The concept sounds simple, but it raises concerns, such as whether these studies could be used by health insurance companies to justify decisions about medical coverage and potentially limit access to health care. Members of Congress in the Obama administration have acknowledged the benefits of such research while also trying to anticipate the concerns. The recent stimulus bill allocated $1.1 billion to three divisions within the Department of Health and Human Services to support comparative effectiveness research. The issue has also been raised on Capitol Hill during discussions about health care reform. Now entering the fray is the Institute of Medicine, the nonprofit organization established by the U.S. government to provide science-based advice on health-related issues. Their report recommends 100 health topics that should receive priority attention and funding. These include a range of specific diseases and treatments, such as hearing loss and drug regimens for Alzheimer's disease, as well as strategies to prevent such health outcomes as unintended pregnancies and injuries from falling by senior citizens. Much more about the report can be found at www.iom.edu.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Dave, I guess first, a story about how piranhas got those very nasty, sharp teeth of theirs.
Exactly. Well, Stuart, this story is, as you said, about how piranhas got their teeth. And researchers don't know a whole lot about this. What they do know about piranhas is that they have a very close relative called the pacu that lives in South America. And the pacu, even though it's a close relative of the piranha, has a few very important differences. One thing is that its teeth aren't nearly as pointy or terrifying as those of the piranha. And another thing is that the pacu's teeth are arranged in two rows, where the piranha only has a single row of teeth. So researchers speculate that the modern ancestor of the pacu and the piranha, as this line evolved, somehow this double row of teeth must have merged into a single row that we see in the piranha, but no one had actually seen evidence of this happening. So this study is all about trying to find this sort of missing link.
And do they, you know, was there a fossil that pointed them to this? I mean,
That's exactly what happened. So they found a fossil, and in fact, they actually refound a fossil. This was a fossil that was collecting dust in a drawer in an Argentinian museum. And the fossil had actually been found in the early 20th century, but nobody really knew what it was or how important it was. And in this new study, researchers went back, re-examined this fossil. And the thing that struck them right away is that they knew it was somehow a relative of the piranha. And the thing that was really interesting about the fossil is, and you can see a picture of this on the site, that the teeth of this fossil are arranged in a sort of a zigzag pattern, so not a straight row of teeth. And that, to them, is evidence of these two rows of teeth merging into one. As these two rows of teeth merge into one, they sort of zigzagged a little bit before they finally straightened out into one. And so they're actually seeing a fish that sort of had this intermediate pattern. And they're naming this fish, this new species based on this fossil, Megapiranha.
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 That makes it sound like it's a big joint, huh?
It does. It actually sounds like a horror movie in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Megapiranha piranensis, which basically means really big piranha. No surprise there. And that's actually a lot bigger. This fish would have actually been a lot bigger than normal piranhas. It would have been about 1 meter long, whereas the average piranha is about 45 centimeters long. So this was a nice sort of capturing this sort of almost evolution in action, capturing actually being able to see this a fossil of this missing link and, you know, giving us this evidence of how piranhas developed their teeth in the first place.
So another adventure in drawer diving at the museum.
Exactly.
So what else have you got for us today?
Well, Stuart, from teeth that that might give you a heart attack to actual heart attacks, this next study is about a marker of inflammation known as C-reactive protein, or CRP. And the reason CRP is so important is it's something that scientists have really honed in on over the past several years as something that might be a predictor for heart attacks and strokes. And obviously, this is important because you'd like to be able to go to your doctor and have your doctor do a test and tell you, you know, you're, you know, so much prone to a heart attack and stroke, and maybe you should modify your diet or whatever. And there's a few lines of evidence that suggest that CRP is a marker. Some studies have shown that people that have elevated levels of CRP also seem to have more heart attacks later in life. And CRP seems to be associated with risk factors of heart attacks like obesity and type 2 diabetes. So there was sort of this sort of casual association, but not a direct association. But then last year, there was a big trial done where researchers showed that elevated CRP levels didn't seem to have anything to do with heart attack. And so this new study sort of revisits that study from last year, but does it on a much bigger scale. They're looking at 128,000 people, which and the study done last year only looked at about 28,000 people, so a lot more people in this new study. And the methodology is similar. What they did was they looked at genes in the body that tend to elevate CRP levels. And the thinking was, well, if you've got these genes or gene variants that would elevate CRP, then you should also be more likely to have heart attacks. But that's not what they found. They found that in this new study, these gene variants didn't matter. If people had these variants or didn't have these variants, they all had, the variants didn't make a difference for whether these people were going to have heart attacks and strokes. So this is really, a lot of people are seeing this really as the nail in the coffin, that CRP really doesn't seem to be an important predictor of heart attack or stroke.
Okay, so if there is no, you know, sort of causal relationship, why then is CRP associated with these other diseases?
Well, it's a good question, and it's possible that CRP is sort of more tangentially associated with some of the other factors that cause these diseases, but isn't a direct cause in itself, or a direct marker in itself, as researchers have thought. And the other really interesting thing to come out of this research is, or the other interesting implication, is that a lot of drug companies had started looking into CRP as maybe something they could target. You know, maybe if we could bring CRP levels down, we can reduce the risk of heart attacks. But now a lot of experts are saying these drug companies are really barking up the wrong tree, because if CRP isn't important, they're basically wasting their money.
Okay, and finally, I think you have a, you know, speaking of barking, I think you have a story answering a question that, frankly, I would never have thought even to ask, which is why dogs don't pop wheelies. Now, why on earth is this even a problem?
Well, it's a great question. It's kind of, I agree, it's kind of a strange premise for a study. And the premise comes from this idea that, you know, a lot of times when we're looking at animal movement, we're sort of looking at steady motions. We're looking at, you know, if we want to find out how a dog or a cat moves, maybe, you know, say, for example, we'll put them on a treadmill and videotape them, or maybe put electrodes on them or whatever. And same with birds, you know, we'll put them in a wind tunnel. But this is all studying sort of this sort of constant motion. And it's not really looking at acceleration, rapid deceleration, which is what you would see, say, in a motorcycle that pops a wheelies, you know, going from sort of a dead stop to a rapid acceleration. So the question is, you know, would animals experience these wheelies, you know, if, you know, under the right circumstances? And it turns out these researchers developed a model which shows that they don't. And I guess that's not surprising, because I've never seen my cats pop wheelies. But what the model shows is that, take dogs, for example, the longer their back is in relation to their legs, the less likely they're going to flip over when they accelerate. And dogs are designed in such a way, just sort of like a race car is designed not to pop a wheelie. Dogs and cats and other animals are designed in such ways that their anatomy pretty much precludes popping a wheelie at the accelerations any of these animals would reach.
Well, how on earth do you sort of measure and test this sort of thing?
Well, these researchers were using high-speed cameras, and they also looked at horses. And with the horses they were actually putting devices on the horses that measure acceleration and deceleration. And with all this sort of fancy equipment, they are basically showing what we know already, that these animals don't pop wheelies, but they're showing why it happens. They're showing that these animals sort of know that that their anatomy is built in such a way that they can't achieve the forces that would allow that to happen. So it's kind of a sort of answering a question you never would have asked in the first place, but it's still kind of a neat study.
Well, I'm still glad we got that one solved. So what else is the Science News team looking at this week?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about a new class of black holes that's been discovered, and we're also looking into a story about solving the mystery of the shrinking sheep.
Another one I wouldn't have thought to ask about.
And for Science Insider, our policy blog, we continue to follow swine flu on an almost daily basis, what's going on with that, and also looking at how California's budget crisis is impacting the UC system. It's having some fairly dramatic effects on researchers there and on science at one of the largest university systems in the world. So be sure to check out all of those stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the Science Podcast for July 3rd, 2009. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.